presentation is maybe a little provocative in its title, Screw You Lamp, but it's actually a very affectionate presentation. It's a presentation that comes out of my kind of falling away from buying the whole Linux Apache MySQL PHP stack and going and looking at other things, and kind of coming back to it and seeing some value in it that I didn't think was obvious, and I hoped that I might be able to share with you and to start some ideas and so on. And so the way I want to set this conversation up, I have to beg your indulgence for. I'm going to use the literal history of the screw as kind of a parable to set up modern IT and all the things it encompasses from a CIO's view, from a CTO's view, from a developer, from an entrepreneur perspective, and so on. So it's a little odd to stand up here and talk about screws and screwing. Yeah, there will be those little silly jokes throughout this whole thing. That's how I'm going to measure how well you're listening, or at least how engaging I've been, so I'm glad I've still got you with you. So, yeah, I'm going to use, oddly enough, the history of the screw as like I said, as a parable, and use it to kind of demonstrate kind of an awakening that I had in myself about the importance of deployment. All right, so I promise not to spend a whole bunch of time on this part of it, but I think it's a good backdrop. If you look at tools and building and engineering before computers, the sort of mechanical and physical engineering, you can go back to antiquity and find things that would be familiar to today's architects and engineers and people who build houses, carpenters, things like that. And that's an interesting thing to me. You can pick up Homer, you can read the Iliad and the Odyssey, and you'll see things that are familiar. And so when you look at how long things like, you know, saws and the basic structural supports and things like that that go into engineering have been around, it's been forever. The screw is a pretty relatively recent kind of a thing. And the reason is it's got manufacturing complexity. And I think manufacturing complexity is almost a perfect parallel to talking about operational things like deployments, backups, and things like that. Okay, so let's talk about this a little bit. So Da Vinci kind of came up with the idea of the screw, or at least he was one of the people who early had an early kind of inkling into it. And he also had the recognition that if you cut a helix into a piece of wood or into a piece of metal, you don't get a screw. So there's a complexity to it. And so Da Vinci kind of came up with this before the 1500s, but you really didn't start to see screws showing up in devices until the mid-1500s. And here's one of those things that sounds very familiar to me. So screws in the 1500s were hard to produce and unreliable. And that pretty much describes my first couple of internet startups. They're hard to produce and unreliable. And so there had to be a certain value proposition. You had to have a lot invested to go and put screws into a device. And so what you saw is they were in things like watches and weapons. Watches and weapons were high-value kind of things. Then you had this kind of dark age where nothing happened for hundreds and hundreds of years, and you had to have all of the industrial kind of revolution grow up until we finally got to the point where you could actually literally mass-produce screws. So it actually happened just before 1800s. Where this gets interesting and where the setup for this whole conversation comes from is I think the screw represented one of the first ever standards wars. And this, I think, is very interesting. So in the 1900s, in the kind of the era of mass production of automobiles and other things like that, there was a standards war between a superior platform, the Robertson square drive screw. So if you're a Canadian, you know this. This is the Canadian screw. And the Canadians got screwed because the Phillips head screwdriver, screw and screwdriver beat them. And the thing about it was that the Phillips head is an inferior screw. Much like some of my old girlfriends. And, hey, you're still with me. So the thing about the... the people I respect no longer respect me. There's at least three of you. Okay, so the Phillips head screw won the standards war, even though it was an inferior screw, because it was self-centering, and that meant that you could use it on assembly lines. And assembly lines are the key here. Assembly lines are what allowed us to have mass-producible consumer goods. So I think that's almost a direct parallel to looking at things like how you do deployments and things like that. So the mass production of things goes back to a guy named Frederick Winslow Taylor. He's the father of scientific management. And I swear I'm done with this kind of stuff in just a second. We'll get into some specifics about the lamp stack. But Frederick Winslow Taylor was the guy who looked at how people build things and started breaking things down into reproducible steps. So it's the efficiency of motion, repeatable motion. People tend to think of him in the context of Henry Ford. Henry was the guy who came up with mass production of automobiles. Wasn't the first guy to build an automobile, but he mass-produced it. And so when I look at this, I say, well, what's the equivalent of mass production in the IT world? And I think what you have to do is you have to start to look at different perspectives. So you can have a perspective of a CIO, you can have a perspective of a CTO, and so on. And I know that CIOs get kind of painted with a negative brush for being the folks who want to have mass production within their staffs, but I think there's a validity to this approach. So the CIO of an organization is looking for something that is the equivalent of repeatable motion or a standardization so that they can get IT mass production. And my argument is that the LAMP stack is a very good way to do that. So in effect, the LAMP stack is the Phillips head of our profession. All right, so that's kind of the setup for this conversation. So what I wanted to do is I wanted to look at different perspectives on the LAMP stack and actually start to highlight some of the benefits to it. And then maybe towards the end, what we're going to do is we're going to see if we can't apply those to some of maybe our other choices for platform and so on. Those of you who know me know that I'm a Ruby on Rails guy, and I'm a Ruby this, and I'm a Ruby that. And yet I'm standing up here saying that I think the LAMP stack is probably the best choice for a bunch of different folks, including the CIO. And the reason I think the CIO chooses the LAMP stack is that it is something that can optimize for operations team productivity. So it's the favorite platform of a CIO because they want the standard Phillips head. What they want as a CIO is what I would call repeatability. So repeatability is kind of a made-up word, right? You probably wouldn't find it in the dictionary. But what I think it means is that you don't have to relearn every time you roll out a new app. And so I think that that's a real value. If you as a CIO can solve the hit-by-the-bus problem where you have one guy who knows how to do that thing, and if he dies, leaves, or decides he doesn't want to do it anymore, you're screwed. Back to the screw thing again. I think that's a really interesting thing. And so repeatability, from my perspective, means three things. In the LAMP stack, there's almost a uniform way to do deployments. You simply, after you have your LAMP server set up, which incidentally is crazy easy because that's what the Linux distros target. So you take a Linux CD, put it in a drive, you click next a bunch of times, you don't even configure it, you end up with a LAMP server. Doing the deployment is a piece of cake. You simply uncopy the files into a web directory and you're off and running. In fact, this kind of deployment has been embraced by Microsoft. When you look at the .NET stuff, .NET was their Microsoft step in the direction away from registries and craziness and this and that to what they call xcopy deployment. So for an ops productivity perspective, it's really, really easy to set up these applications. Updating them is very simple, too. It's another xcopy, and maybe if you're doing an operating system update using Yum or something else, it's quite simple. Backup is standardized, and recovery is standardized. And this is interesting to me, because so much of the state and everything else goes into the database. You only really have to worry about making sure what's in the database is present. Because if your systems fall over, if they die, as long as you have the database backed up, all the state's there to recover from that, all you got to do is do that xcopy installation again, and you're off and running. So I'm looking at Jamie in the back here. Jamie is updating his WordPress blog about 5 times a week. In fact, this afternoon he's got a power WordPress kind of a thing. And so he can kind of support this whole notion. You have your database with all of your data, the PHP and the stuff that runs it, you're just swapping out behind the scenes. And so it's got a very strong, I think, recoverability perspective. So I think there's kind of an unacknowledged genius behind file-based deployment, and I think this is going to kind of pay back as we talk about this a little bit further. All right, so I stand up here, and I have to kind of talk about LAMP and how, as a CIO, you want very few deviations from the standard. You want your people to be interchangeable. You want your platforms to be interchangeable. And this is why these guys kind of get a bad reputation. But ultimately, I think what they're doing is solving the hit-by-the-bus problem, and they're really kind of taking a page from Voltaire. So Voltaire gets misquoted all the time. Perfect is the enemy of the good. So LAMP might not be perfect, but it's really good for a whole bunch of things, and I think it fits very squarely into the CIO's view. But I don't work as a CIO. Typically, I work as a CEO or a CTO. And when I'm a CTO, I want Voltaire to bite me. I don't find the operations side of it to be so immediately compelling, because instead of optimizing for ops team, what I want to do is optimize for developer productivity. So I talked about being a Ruby guy or Rails guy and this and that. And this goes to that. I want expressive languages. I play with every crazy new language to see if this language can get me more capabilities out of the developers and so on. So I want to wring out of my developers more and more productivity. And so from a CTO's perspective, I say, you know, LAMP really isn't my favorite platform. But I have to revise my estimate of this. And the reason I want to revise my estimate of this is it actually has something to do with deployment. I think deployment's really at the heart of all of this. When you look into LAMP and the PHP component of it, LAMP is a very CGI-like runtime. What I mean by that is there's no long-running processes. There's no global state, things like that. In fact, I'm skipping ahead. So with the CGI style approach, what that means is a request comes in, the system spins up a process to do that work, shuts it down when it's done, and moves on. So there's no long-term state. So what that means then is your failure cases are isolated. So when you have a request that causes some kind of fault, it disappears as soon as that request is over. On top of that, you can start to forget things like memories. Or if not forget them, they certainly play a smaller role because the lifetime of that process is such that a memory leak doesn't live long enough to get in your head. And there's no global state. And so I think Robert is in the room, Robert Fisher. So this is a shout out to my functional programming brethren, Robert. Functional programming people love to leave out global variables and global state and any kind of change state. And so we kind of simplified that a little bit and made it repeatable. But the PHP CGI runtime has all of these things. So to me, as a CTO, I have to look at this and say, you know, there's actually a real win on this from a developer productivity perspective as long as I look past my first release. If I look at my first release as being the only thing, then I might choose a more expressive language. But when I can look and say, well, after we're running and we have to go figure out why things are falling over and where are all of our memory leaks and where is the global state polluting things and so on, I think ultimately we get real value to the developer from their productivity, and it's kind of analogous to test-driven development in that it's one of those things that appears to take more time, but over the lifetime of a product, I think you're going to get real wins out of it. All right, so good developer productivity, but will it scale, I think, is a very good question. Will these things scale up? I did a version of this talk to a bunch of would-be CIOs a few weeks ago, and their whole big thing was, is the LAMP stack going to scale up? And I think we can take a couple of examples to say, yes, it will. So first of all, PHP is the kind of standard that the Wikipedia folks use for MediaWiki. Facebook's customer-facing stuff is all on PHP, and it's the Yahoo platform of choice. So you have large installations of PHP all over the place. And in fact, I think when you look at the sort of proto-CGI style deployments, and you look at Google App Engine, that's a further confirmation. The Google App Engine actually uses a CGI-style approach. Now, under the covers, it might be a little different, but as a programmer, you program with the notion that the state exists for the lifetime of the request, and then it's gone. So all of this, to me, it means, as a CTO, I think there's some value in it. And in fact, Amazon says that about 70% of the time of a product development has to do with cleaning that shit up. So if we can clean that stuff up, violated number two rule of presenting, never swear, I think we're cool, and by being able to scale up, it all kind of works out. All right, so I want to change perspectives here. I said that I was going to go through different perspectives, and so what I'm trying to do is look at people in the room. So we've got some CEOs, we've got some CIOs, we've got some CTOs. I tend to like to self-identify as an entrepreneur. As an entrepreneur, I have yet another thing to optimize for. So I'm not looking for ops productivity. I'm kind of interested in developer productivity because obviously I want to get my stuff out there really quickly. But ultimately, I approach entrepreneurial ventures in a Darwinistic approach. I want to vet them. I want to throw up 1,000 ideas, and when those ideas work, one of them takes off, I want to run with it. So instead of looking at how things scale up, I actually want to look at how things scale down. And this, I think, is interesting. I don't know if you guys read, there's a guy named Eric Sink. He writes about the business of software. He describes the marketplace for software as a barrel. And in this barrel, you put rocks. And the size of the rocks reflect the size of the market. So you put a giant rock in there for operating systems, and a slightly smaller rock in there for desktop productivity, and some rocks of about the same size for databases and things like that. Ultimately, you look at this barrel and you say, barrel's full. But the thing is, there's lots of little spaces inside the barrel between the rocks. And as tools have gotten better, as an entrepreneur, now I can go after smaller markets. But I'm going to go after some markets that are so tiny that I'm just not sure if they exist. So it's very important for me to be able to scale down. I want to be able to literally pour sand into that barrel and try thousands of different ideas, and so it's got to scale down for me. From a LAMP perspective, LAMP does this. My personal blog site also runs MediaWiki, so it's got the equivalent of Wikipedia on it. I run a gallery program. My single device with very little memory overhead running PHP scales down to run multiple apps. And so when I talk about optimizing for vetting ideas, what I really mean is I want to be able to try things and not have to spend a lot of money on it. And I know you and other people are kind of keen on this idea as well, and so I want to run with that a little bit. So LAMP does it for me. Now I have to do a thing that's a little painful for me. I have to take my favorite language and kind of explain to you why I don't think Ruby scales down. And I'm not going to do this just within the bounds of Ruby on Rails. I'm actually going to do this within the bounds of all Ruby frameworks. So it's a big tent here. So how does Ruby scale down? Well, poorly. And so we want to go through different deployment options. How are you going to scale down Ruby? Well, we started with this notion of CGI as kind of a cloud computing style of starting small and being able to grow bigger. How does Ruby deal with CGI? Well, it's interesting. If you look at Google's App Engine, it uses Python. And the reason it uses Python, among other things, is it's the favorite language at Google. But Python has an interesting side effect. It's optimized for startup speed. Because Python gets compiled to that kind of bytecode stuff that they have, starting up a standalone process for a single request has lower overhead than what you would do with Ruby. With Ruby, you find yourself reading tens and tens and tens of thousands of lines of code before you get to the point where you have something that actually executes. And so Ruby doesn't work well in a CGI world. Okay, so how else could I deploy Ruby? Well, I like the notion of a shared runtime. Between doing PHP back in the old days, and actually doing it kind of well, I started a company that was a PHP-based shopping cart system that went through a series of acquisitions and ultimately ended up at Microsoft. So I've done the PHP thing. But I kind of drifted away from that, and I went to Perl as a language. And in the Perl world, we have something called Mod Perl. It's a runtime that says, okay, Perl is not optimized for startup. Perl is a lot like Ruby in that case. It's a big, heavy language with tens and tens of thousands of lines of code to have to run before a request can be processed. So the Perl community got together and said, let's embed Perl in the web server itself. Then we can load all of those files into memory and just keep them there. So a shared runtime. That's the shared runtime model. Unfortunately, this probably doesn't work so well with Ruby, and I want to talk about why. Now, for those of you, and I know a number of you in the room are Rails programmers, this is not the Rails isn't thread safe argument. The shared runtime argument is not based on Rails being or not being thread safe. Instead, what it has to do with is kind of an approach to deployment that almost all of the Ruby frameworks have taken. So almost all of the Ruby frameworks have taken inspiration from Rails. And so Rails went through a bunch of different kind of steps, but ultimately kind of the way you run Rails is you take a web server that embeds a Ruby environment in it, and you run one application per one of these things. So if I want to run 10 applications, I have to have 10 separate standalone copies of Mongrel, and that's a problem. The reason that's a problem is that you can't run multiple Ruby apps in the same runtime because the convention, this kind of monoculture of the way they do deployment, is such that you use something called singletons, and so you literally can't run two copies of any framework in one Ruby runtime. And so what this means to me is that I can't run 100 applications on my server. I consider my server free. It's spent money. I can put 100 lightweight PHP apps on it, but I can't put 100 lightweight Ruby apps because there's all of this overhead that goes with it. And I think it's important to note cheap and free are not the same thing. I posted a topic about this to a discussion forum, and the kind of universal result was use Amazon EC2. Well, Amazon EC2 is $70 per system, and so if I want to do 10 ideas, let's just do simple math, call it 10 systems, I got to pay $700 a month. I've already got a server that in the PHP world will run dozens of applications, so maybe we ought to pay attention to that. So Ruby, not so much my favorite from an entrepreneurial perspective. So I'm talking quickly, which is kind of my habit. But we've covered so far different views that I think all point to some real value in the PHP stack. So we went from the CIO's view, where they're getting operational efficiency, to the CTO's view, where we're getting developer productivity, to the entrepreneurial thing. I think that the next one that's interesting and kind of drives from a similar set of motivations as entrepreneurialism is open source. When you work on open source, you're doing it because it's something you care about. When I do entrepreneurial things, I have a passion about this. This is me deciding to spend my time on it. And so from an open source perspective, I think that there's a really strong case to be made for PHP as your sort of choice of platform because you're optimizing for the bazaar. You know, you're all familiar with the cathedral and the bazaar. You want to get everyone out there contributing to this. And so I'm actually going to quote a guy here. There's a pretty well-versed blog author named Ian Bicking, who talks about this. He's been looking at this deployment model from the Python worldview. And he says, being interested in a project requires that you'd be able to use it and use it casually as the point of entry for many developers. Right now, most developers can't use open source web apps. I think deployment concerns are a huge part of this, and given the better deployment story, it's no surprise that PHP is the basis for most viable open source applications. And so I think there's a real psychology behind this. You want to do an open source project, you want to get people involved with it, you want to take a page from Kathy Sierra. Kathy Sierra is the head first lady. She's the one who talks about brain-friendly learning and how to create passionate users. And I'm going to boil what usually she spends an entire day talking about down to one sentence. You want your users to go from thinking, I suck, to thinking, I rule in as short a period of time as possible. And so I've tried to participate in a number of different open source projects, and the ones I've had success with are the kinds where I unzip the package and I go. So from an open source perspective, from the casual user, from hooking the casual user, so that the casual user can go from I suck to I rule in a short period, that's great. All right, one last thing to talk about, and then I'm going to wrap all this up in a hopefully a somewhat novel way. The fact that no one laughed tells me I completely lost you when I put a picture of the enterprise.
Just
laugh
quiet.
Yeah. Or now it's not with me, it's more of an at me. What are you going to do? So the last perspective where I think WAMP makes sense, and by the way, this is all of IT. By the time we've covered this, we've covered every angle you could ever possibly want to participate in, short of like processor design. So LAMP in the enterprise is actually a really interesting thing, because I think what you do is you optimize for reality. And what I mean by optimize reality is that we have a history, a decades-long history of watching IT move from centrally controlled up to the periphery. And so I think there's a really strong case to be made for LAMP in this, and I want to demonstrate that a little bit here. Okay, so how do we support letting IT move to the periphery? How do we take the power and put it in the people's hands? Well, people tend to be power users. So I'm looking at Steve Borsch over here. Steve is a marketing guy, but Steve can put together the most complicated mix-ups of all of these open LAMP applications to make really compelling things without being a developer. And so I think that being able to move from the developer to the power user is a really interesting thing. And in the enterprise, using LAMP to do this is pretty straightforward. There's two modes to it. First one is kind of a Unix pipes philosophy. There are lots of open source applications that fulfill one little tiny piece. And so if I can take that part and I can pipe it to something else and I can tie all these things together, I think I get a lot of real value out of that. And so when I talk about that, what I want to do is I want to take these compact apps and I want to build them and combine them. And the thing that I find is really interesting is that most mature open source LAMP stack applications have some kind of authentication mechanism that allows you to authenticate outside of their own database. So if you're an enterprise and you have an Active Directory where all of your users authenticate, there are great ways to be able to connect that Active Directory to your PHP apps. And if that's not enough, then you're going to be able to do APIs and stuff. So you get to the point where we can do, in effect, enterprise mashups. Other approach to this is what I would call anchor apps. And here's primarily what I think of as kind of a friendly version of the walled garden. When you look at what I call anchor apps, it's kind of a Facebook analog. If you look at WordPress as a platform, it's getting very, very interesting. So first of all, it's got a plugin architecture. And I can tell that it's kind of come of age because the plugin architecture will allow you to write plugins and the themes, the way that things are presented, have to be plugin aware. So it actually almost matches up perfectly to that Facebook analog. And so I think that ultimately all of these things allow you to produce what is the equivalent of VBA, doing macros, the way you could do Office integrations, where semi-technical user can start to pull pieces of information out of all of these places, put them together. And so for me, that's a real win for the enterprise. And so I think the LAMP platform is there for them as well. All right. If people are still paying attention, and I hope you are, you might have noticed we're missing one perspective. And it's kind of a shame that I've spent now 25 minutes talking about the one perspective that actually reflects what most of you do. And that missing perspective is the developer perspective. So far, I've talked about all of this stuff from what I would call kind of a leader position. I'm a leading CIO, I'm a leading CTO, I have an open source project, I'm an entrepreneur. As a developer, and my feelings may not be the same as yours, as a developer, LAMP isn't my favorite platform. I don't really like PHP. I'm fine if you do, I'm not religious about it, but I like the expressiveness of Ruby. And I have to admit, I'm always kind of on the fringe. I'm learning about I/O and things, like languages that people don't pay that much attention to because I find that interesting. So what is unfortunate about this is that as a developer, I want to optimize for my enjoyment, and I have to do that within the bounds of all these other folks that we talked about. And those folks kind of control the way we work. And so I might not actually be able to optimize for happiness as a developer if I've got to use Lent. And so ultimately, I think that there's a solution to this, and I think that that solution comes in the form of virtualization. And so it's such a shame that my picture of Hugo Weaving doesn't shine a little brighter, because it's a great visual. But basically, what I want to talk about is all of those points, and here's where I go off my slides and I just kind of have a conversation with you. All of those points that we talked about, I think you can nail down very well, very reasonably, using virtualization. So let's take a look at that from a perspective. As a CIO, I want to be able to deploy easily. Well, I can take an image, a virtual machine image, and I can copy it. And then I can take that virtual machine image and I can do a little bit of personalization. So I might have a virtual machine image that is my blogging platform that we're going to use for the basis of some internal corporate communication thing. I just clone a copy of it. And in fact, if you're an Amazon Web Service user who uses EC2, there's a movable type EC2 image so that you can go from no system at all to running blog in a second or two. So it's great from a CIO's perspective. Backing those things up, well, backing virtualized images up is not a bad thing. And in fact, you can also keep hot copies of them. You can do all of those kind of things. From a CTO's perspective, it's great because I can ship to my developers a working environment. They can work on it. And as long as we got those kind of hooks, those APIs and other things to make working with it usable, then I think we're in good shape. As an entrepreneur, it's great because I can do whatever language I want, and I just ship off the image to when I'm ready to deploy it. And if I'm worried about optimizing or having 100 versions of this, I can use swap memory, and I can turn the priority down on the CPU and so on. With open source, I think this is the biggest way. If instead of sitting down and pulling down, so I was in Chris's thing about Memcached and using it with MySQL. Well, in order for him to get set up in his development environment for this combination of these two open source projects, he had to spend a couple of days pulling together source files and compiling and doing all this and all that. Well, in the virtualized world, you make one copy of it, you ship it off. Matt Dornquist in the back here has a virtualized image for its crash plan. So being able to just take something and instantly get started, an instant setup is huge for all of these kind of folks. And so where I kind of see opportunities in this is to take a look at that Web 2.0 world. Look at mashups, look at APIs, look at discovery, look at all of those kind of things that have made Web 2.0 really interesting, and figure out how you can apply these to the virtualized world. So how can we let Steve Borsch take a copy of WordPress and a copy of MediaWiki and start to fuse those things together? How do you get folks to be able to do that? Because I'm convinced that there are entrepreneurial opportunities here. And I think you don't have to be too creative. You just look at what's worked with LAMP as a stack. You apply it to the virtualized stack, and I think you're off and running. So I only took 30 minutes of my 50-minute thing. That's kind of all I had from a prepared perspective. I don't really know where to go with it. I don't know where to go with this from here. Talk for 30 minutes without anyone asking a question. Any comments on what I've said? Anything seem completely off topic, on topic? Anything? Back of the room.
Does the Fusion thing for Rails solve the problem we're talking about?
Yeah, so mod Rails. Mod Rails is really interesting. When you look under the covers, mod Rails is fast CGI. So what it does is it's a really simple way to get a Rails app running in Apache. So that's a good thing, right? You install this module and it's off and running. But it still has that kind of underlying limitation of each application is, in effect, in its own sandbox. And incidentally, that's actually one of the weak spots in my argument about virtualization here. Is that you take Ruby, you put it on a virtualized system, you still have those same one runtime per application things. I just think that with a virtualized system, you're more flexible in your billing. So ModRuby is interesting, but ultimately it acts like fast CGI. There's a long running process back there, and so it still has that same, at least from the entrepreneur perspective, that same hard to scale down to let me do many, many of them at one time. Good question. Thanks.
If I can just comment on that, I just set up a website using it to try it out.
I saw your tweet.
Yes. And it's true, like what you're saying is true, like it is running in a sandbox, but it does have an interesting property that would help, I think, your case, where you have a lot of little apps that aren't getting much use,
okay.
Except for, of course, where you got huge. So
I had to shut it down for the exact same reason.
But if you had, like, 10 little apps, you might be able to run it on a decent application isn't used within like 120 seconds, it actually shuts it down.
Sure.
And so you can say, okay, I want this to run on up to 7 processes, say, so you can handle 7 simultaneous requests. And if 7 people are connecting, it'll fire them up and then shut them down as they become unused.
Sure.
So I think that's kind of interesting. I mean, it still uses a crap ton of RAM because, I mean, Rails, I think the biggest problem with Rails is just that it uses so much RAM.
Yeah.
Like, if Rails used 10 megabytes of RAM per process instead of 60, it would be a lot easier to do what you want.
So if you ever profiled Merv and some of the other things, they still run up there. I think a part of it is just that Ruby is a very verbose language with lots and lots and lots of libraries. And so if you profile the simplest of any of these apps, and you do a line count and the number of lines that have to be parsed, actually just read off the disk, then parsed, then traversed, there's an incredible amount of stuff that happens before the process actually runs. And so that was kind of the basis for Python's not so bad after all, but maybe PHP is even better from that perspective. So thanks for the thing.
I had a question too, though. I think your point is right on that, PHP, you see more open source PHP apps because they're easier to deploy.
Yep.
But as a developer, I don't want to deal with PHP. It's just so hard to write a secure PHP program.
Sure. So Martin and the row ahead of you might disagree because he's at Clockwork, and Clockwork does all their stuff in PHP. So yeah, it's a hard thing for me to answer because I'd kind of fallen away from the PHP flock. It's not for me the secure perspective. I like the expressiveness of Ruby. And so when I was working on this, and I still haven't figured out the company around this yet. Otherwise, I'd be pitching it. I was thinking about, Joel Spolsky, about year and a half ago, had all of this controversy surrounding him because he dished on Ruby and then went on to tell everyone how they had created their own language for all of their apps. And there was all this controversy surrounding that, but ultimately what he explained and what they've gone on to describe in a fair amount of technical detail is that they built a kind of meta language that looks a lot like, in their case, ASP, the old school ASP. But what it would do is they could take that and they could target it to different platforms. So they write their app in something that looks a lot like ASP, but if you wanted to deploy it on a customer with LAMP, it came out of the other end as PHP. And so I went through this whole thing about, what about using PHP as a kind of a virtual machine? The JRuby guys, the people who write languages for fun and ultimately for employment, that's a project that might be approachable to folks like that. It's not approachable to me. I kind of dabble in languages. I've never written one that's gotten beyond simple calculator. But my concern with that is, so let's say you come up with some language that then targets PHP. So you come up with something that looks like Ruby or Python or IO or whatever your scratches your itch. The setup then for someone to contribute to it is not that they get the work product, but they also then have to set up that whole environment to allow them to write in that language and then compile it back down. And so you start putting steps between that and say, I can't figure out how you keep that one step from, hey, I'm running it to, hey, I'm editing it. I did a server change recently, and I went through two different versions of a photo gallery site that didn't have a migration path between them. And so ultimately, I managed to hack enough of my stuff over to get all of my photos in, but the order of the things were wrong. And so I just went into the code, and I found a thing that said how to sort, and the option I wanted wasn't one of them, so I wrote my own. I replaced one of theirs with 3 lines of PHP. Well, I haven't programmed PHP since 98. So being able to sit down and do that short path, I contributed something, I think it's really powerful, and so I don't know how you get there. I thought about, I'm speaking at this conference called Ruby Fringe, July, and I'm going to do a kind of call to arms to the Ruby folks. The Ruby folks should actually make a much better kind of mod Perl-based approach to things if they would just get rid of one thing, and that's using what I call singletons for their configuration. If they can let the singletons effectively act as a global variable, and so the reason you can't run 2 thread-safe Mervs or thread-safe Fedoras or thread-safe Sinatras or whatever, Fedora's not the right choice there, the 2 thread-safe Ruby frameworks in the same runtime is that they use this kind of global namespace thing called a singleton that colludes, so you can't run 2 at the same time. So I think you could maybe fix Ruby in that way, but there's so much of a track record of people doing stuff in PHP that there's a certain point where you just kind of love the one you're with. Paul?
What about
Ruby and maybe contain Ruby itself so that you can have multiple sandboxes of the same runtime, share compiled classes, but essentially have a pool of different global namespaces. I mean,
sure. So here's my answer, and I actually want the counter answer. So in a corporate setting, the last year I was the interim CTO at GovDelivery. I pushed JRuby on them. They had an existing Java stack. But for me, when I sit down, I'm like, okay, I'm going to go from some empty hardware or an empty slice at Slicehost or something up to running Java stack world. That's a lot for me to do as a single person. So it's accessible to some of those people in that kind of, you know, who wins and who loses. But from my perspective, the overhead to get that set up versus the benefit that it gets me, I just never got it.
So there's two things, and I'm asking about one, and I think you're answering about the other. One is just that the working, like Apache, JRuby, Java web app stack is a pain in the ass to set up.
Yep.
You know, I think that's solvable if somebody puts a lot of work into packaging and figuring it. But then there's the second problem, which is really the driver for your talk, which is that you want to run a whole bunch of little apps with very low overhead per app.
Yep.
So leaving aside the fact that it's just hard to configure JRuby and Apache and get it up running, you know, if you can solve that problem, then would it be sufficient to have JRuby set up a bunch of little sandboxes but maybe share compiled classes so that like the memory overhead per app is much lower, but each app has its own little namespace. So you've got one compiled version of all of the classes, but multiple little memory areas, which is like, here's your world with your single Mr. One app. And at this point, now the apps are very small. I'm wondering if JRuby might have done that.
Super interesting, but I wonder about monkey patching. So you have one, Luke, I guess you would.
Well, what I was going to say is I think right now the problem with that is, I mean, I think they could share some of the classes, but essentially, like, each app inside the JVM is running in its own container, precisely because of the singleton problem. Like, they have to have a different copy of the class because if you're setting a possible variable in there, you know.
I'm wondering if it's, I mean, I was trying to figure, I wonder if there's some way to factor out, you know, 50 of the 60 megabytes
sure.
each app takes.
Yeah.
That well, are probably, I guess, on the Tomcat always goes through this on that. It does kind of copy on read, or copy on write approach to class loading. So that's a problem that's been approached by the Java open source community at least once before. But I don't know about running it under Apache.
I'm a little afraid to ask this next question. Like I'm forcing you to forcing you to throw a pork chop in the synagogue or something, but I haven't heard about anything .NET. I mean, where does the whole Microsoft platform fit into this universe?
Doug? I'm a fan, not just because he's in the room, of Microsoft. I had the whole, like, my company got consumed by Microsoft, and I spent a year inside. Really cool, smart people, everything else like that. .NET is good. Good platform, everything else. Much of what I guess you say here, I think, held true in the ASP world, but I think in the ASP.NET world, a whole lot less. The last thing I did before I went to Rails was an ASP.NET app. And I loved it because I could have the templates in the front and I could have this code behind. And that code behind, I think, is the place where you kind of where you break off some folks. And so that might be okay. I think you can probably make... I don't even know how to answer the question. That's why I'm stumbling around up here. Let me think about this for a second. CIO's perspective, the configuration of ASP.NET applications on an IIS server, pretty standard. You put the you create the sort of virtual folder for it, you put the stuff in there, and you go. My one little fig leaf to the .NET world here was saying that, yeah, they actually do that xcopy style deployment. So you've certainly got that there. I'm trying to go through from a CTO's perspective. I continue to maintain that a really good ASP.NET person can probably run pretty even with a Ruby on Rails person. And there might be something to be said for the fact that when they get into scale, it strikes me as a crazily odd thing to say, the ASP.NET stuff might actually be an easier scale problem.
I mean, it seems like it solves all of these things except the thorn in everybody's side is expensive.
Well, there is one.
What about the memory that has mod mono? Mono is basically the open source implementation of that.
Right.
And you can do mod mono on Apache. I'm pouring over that right now.
And I don't know, back on the startup load, what, you know, things running on mono, running on virtualization, running on what that does. But
so I was going to call this screw you Microsoft, but they have a lot more money and lawyers. So I thought screw you Lamp would just be easier. No, I think you can pretty much make parallels for all of those things in the .NET world, certainly. And Microsoft has gotten very I think good about thinking about virtualization these days. There's rumors of their cloud computing thing coming online and so on. I'm not as current as that. Stick with what I at least sort of. Jamie,
I comment to your question. Being intimately close to Microsoft-based very large homestead. The problem with Windows, they may be catching up with Windows Server 2008, but you know, the support for true virtualization in like a server farm kind of instance is pathetic. Before Windows Server 2008, where in Server 2008 you can finally install a specific virtualized machine that, for example, ignores GUI, which is like an amazing revelation of the Windows world. But I mean, the other part of where the challenge comes is that while ASP.NET may solve a lot of those problems, it comes with so much weight. And it's the same thing that the Java stack comes with, and really in all of the compiled environments come with. And we may go back to trying to solve problems where that's a necessary evil, but right now it doesn't seem that it is a necessary evil. And so unless you have that weight already and you really can't shed yourself of it, I don't know why.
Are you talking about developer effort weight or what?
Both, honestly.
Yeah, I think the point that Dan is making, which is very good, is that in the Java world, GPM has a huge runtime overhead, but you only have to do it once per server, right? So, like, on my personal website, I run a few apps that are all Java-based, and like I said, it's really a pain to get that configured and running well. But once it's running, I can just throw a dozen more apps into the same Jetty instance.
Until there's an exception or memory leak or...
But, I don't have trouble with that. I mean, if you do,
We're just getting out restless.
Sure, talk to me after. It's easy to positively fix it.
So, I'm a confused guy here. Are you saying that you use LAMP, there's no need for virtualization, or use LAMP, there's no need for, if you use LAMP, there's no need for virtualization.
Sure.
That the instances that you want from an entrepreneurial standpoint. So what is the point
of virtualization?
Your presentation. What are you saying?
He feels screwed.
Hold on, let me start over here.
I go with LAMP. Do I need virtualization? Here's a question. I can run everything.
I think the screw is a parallel. Wait, sorry, I already said that. I don't know. I've got 45 minutes to get this far, so if I fail that badly.
I don't need to fail, but I'm saying that, I've got a LAMP instance, and I can run as many PHP applications that I want.
Yep.
Is there still a case for virtualization at this point?
Yeah, sure. And the case for virtualization is I like programming in PHP. And so I want to be able to have all of these same benefits. I want to have the deployment. I want to have all of these other things. I want the speed of things, the flexibility, and so on. So what I see is that there are traits that I identify throughout this as being places where LAMP excels. And I'm saying that we can do a lot of those same things, and as a person who prefers a different language and a different this and a different that, I can get a lot of those same benefits by changing my deployment model from LAMP to a virtualized thing. And so the thesis of this is that we've, for a really long time, ignored or kind of talked down deployment. But deployment is the game. That's where everything starts. It's where it's kind of the make or break kind of a thing. And LAMP has such a good deployment thing that it fits well for all of these people. There's all these ancillary benefits for it. And so, if only we could deal with deployment. And so when Paul's giving examples and when Jamie's giving examples and Luke and so on, when Andrew's asking about .NET, there's a large, large deployment element to this. And I think having a canned ready-made virtual image that lets you get up and running, whether you're editing an open source thing for your own use, or you're putting it together, a stack of them like Borsch will do to create some media property or other things, I think that is a really powerful thing. And so I think we can get that goodness from a deployment perspective with virtualization, and then we can sew all those things together in the same way that we sew mashups together and use APIs and so on. So the stuff that the kind of combination of Web 2.0 and Linux LAMP put together is now accessible to us in this other method. So that's my point. That was like 2 minutes.
So just to throw a curveball in, I mean, you've talked about mashups a lot. I mean, to what extent could you sort of rephrase this whole presentation as being about moving in the direction of being able to mash up what's on your server, where you have some PHP stuff, some Java stuff, some Ruby stuff, and the maintenance of all that isn't actually that much of a headache. So you can start using that stuff interchangeably. You get the strength of, like, you don't have to rewrite WordPress because you want to get away from PHP, and you can use the Rails app because it's hot, and you can use the Java app because it's enterprise ready. And, like, which I don't know how .NET would fit in there, because .NET sort of isn't so Linux friendly. But
So can I rephrase that as, we're kind of in this world where everything's got hooks, and so you can take pieces of what is interesting to you and hook them all together. I think you can do that. I think it's a loosely coupled approach versus a kind of a, like LAMP is a stack. And what I think you're saying is a loosely coupled thing where I've got this, and this. They have inputs and outputs, and I want to sew them all together. And so I might have to give them some kind of encapsulating Chrome in the form of a web server component that I've written, maybe in Rails, but if you could pull in pieces of those other things and use RESTful APIs and things like that, then yeah, I think that's all very possible. I think steal a little what Jamie was saying, where before we were talking about lots of, there's a lot of stuff that went with the deployment and the kind of support of that, and if we can just say, well, instead of doing a big stack, it's a Java stack, it's a .NET stack, we can do little, not even stacks, but just like little Lego blocks and stick them together to make a stack of any shape. Awesome.
Yeah, I think, at least to me, the sort of conclusion to your argument for virtualization might be best answered by the Google Apps Engine, which is just completely, you know, it just, I guess it takes the LAM out of LAMP. And in Google Apps case, it's
would that mean it takes the lane out of LAMP?
you gotta sell that to Google. That's pretty good. Right now it's just Python, but they say they'll add support for more languages as it grows. But to me, the beauty of it is that, you know, you start with zero. You know, no servers, no money, no databases. I mean, you can't really use existing applications on it.
I, for one, welcome our new Google overlords.
Yeah, I do too. I'm building a project on it, and it's a lot of fun. But what it seems to me like the sort of the virtualization that you seem to be talking about still relies on LAMP as its foundation. It's just sort of sealed LAMP bubbles that you can pass around.
See, I don't actually care what the bubble is. The bubble can be opaque. The bubble can be opaque as long as it allows things to pass in and out of the membrane.
But as it stands currently, you know, as everybody but Google is doing, you have to have the LAMP, you know, that stack in whatever virtualized container it is. Like Xen slices LAMP, AMI is mostly LAMP.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, and especially in terms of what you're talking about, with trying to get Ruby to scale better, I think you're screwed either way, because it's still Linux, it's still Apache. I mean,
I see that we're kind of out of time, so this is a conversation I think we can kind of go on and on with. I hope this was interesting. I wish to give me some feedback afterwards, and then everyone come on down. We're having a panel discussion with folks from Microsoft, the Splitrock Venture partners, the Robert Stevens, the founder of Geek Squad. It's going to be a great state-of-the-state talk. It was about 10 minutes in the main auditorium, so we'll see you there. Thanks.